Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
So I think being more transparent about what each farmer's market is doing is a good idea. And along with that is educating the public about what to look for.
We're revisiting our conversation with Jennifer Mita Robinson today. More talk about farmers markets and why local food works best when growers and customers both show up. Oh, and I'm Mark Chilla, in again for Annie Corrigan. I'm excited about our recipes today, pickled peppers and slow-grilled chicken, and a couple reports from Harvest Public Media about farmers taking responsibility for fertilizer runoff that results in water pollution. It's an expensive problem to fix on some farms, but technology can help. I'm in the host chair, which means Lou Ann Johnson is in the food news chair this week.
Well, by now you've probably heard the statistic. Americans throw away one-third of the food we could be eating. In 15 years, that figure could be cut in half. At least that's what the USDA and EPA are hoping. This week, government officials and private sector groups announced a first-ever national plan to address America's food waste problem. According to NPR's report, Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack said, quote, rather than pitch food, let's figure out how to redirect it, unquote. That means they want to make it easier for manufacturers and grocers to donate food that would usually end up in the landfill. This goal of cutting food waste by 50% by 2030 is, as of now, voluntary. I encourage you to check out Harvest Public Media's series of reports on this very issue. From eartheats.org, just search for food waste. The conversation about tossed-out food in school cafeterias goes hand-in-hand with the discussion of nutrition. The Journal of the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics published a study recently that found longer lunch periods could lead to healthier choices and less food in the trash. 1,000 students from 6 elementary and middle schools took place in the study, led by researchers from the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. School kids who had less than 20 minutes to eat also consumed less of their food, almost 13% less of their entrees. Those who had 25 minutes to eat were more likely to pick a fruit with their lunch as well, over half, as opposed to 44% of the kids with less time. The researchers noted that 30 million students are currently receiving discounted or free lunch and rely on school lunch for a bulk of their nutrition. Antibiotic resistance is a public health threat, with 2 million Americans getting sick with antibiotic-resistant bugs and 23,000 dying every year. The Chain Reaction Report, conducted by several organizations, looked into major restaurants' policies regarding antibiotic use in their meat products. Of the 25 largest fast food chains, only 5 received a passing grade. Of those, only Chipotle and Panera received A grades. Chick-fil-A received a B, while Dunkin' Donuts and McDonald's received C grades. In the report, the 5 top-rated restaurants were the only ones to have adopted antibiotic-limiting policies, and the top 2 were the only ones to publicly announce they would source only antibiotic-free meat. And as summer fades in the rearview mirror, it's time for Americans to turn to pumpkins. Americans love pumpkin-flavored things. Pumpkin pie tops the list as pumpkin pie filling sales totaled $134.8 million last year. Pumpkin cream, coffee, and baked items also make the top 10, according to a recent Nielsen report. Even pumpkin dog food makes the cut. What doesn't make the cut? Real pumpkins. Declining sales dating from 2011 have accounted for 8.6 million fewer pumpkins sold, while pumpkin-flavored products have jumped 76% since 2011. After coming under fire last year for artificial ingredients in their flavors, companies like Starbucks and Panera are reformulating their pumpkin spice flavorings to include real pumpkin. Pepperidge Farms, Ben & Jerry's, and Thomas's Breads have all released limited edition pumpkin goodies containing real pumpkin. From the grower's perspective, fewer pumpkins may become pumpkin pie due to weather issues in Illinois, which are affecting the canned pumpkin crop. And harvest season is coming earlier this year for some farmers across the nation, where dry, hot weather has caused pumpkins to ripen more quickly. As always, there's more to know about these stories. Find the collection of links in the top post at eartheats.org.
A big thanks to Lou Ann Johnson for giving us the week's news.
Anytime, Mark.
Chemical runoff from farm fields can pollute waterways and destroy ecosystems. But farmers who want to reduce pollution face a daunting, expensive task. As Harvest Public Media's Amy Mayer reports, some new tools may help farmers decide how to decrease contamination and clean up their fields.
I'm standing on the edge of the South Skunk in central Iowa, one of many rivers that wind through the farmland of the Midwest. Nitrogen, phosphorus, and other chemicals that farmers put on their fields to help crops grow can wash into these waterways, polluting drinking water and, ultimately, the Gulf of Mexico.
This is a broad-scale problem.
Mark David is a professor at the University of Illinois.
It's most tile drain fields. It's not 1 out of 100, it's 90 out of 100. It's the system we've built loses nitrate out tiles, unless you do something else.
Tiles are systems of tubes under farm fields that collect excess water and route it to the edges. That keeps crops from drowning, but it also concentrates nutrients in water flowing across the Midwest and into the Mississippi River. That's contributed to a dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico, an oxygen-starved area where marine critters die. David says for years, agriculture denied its role. But now, some farmers are taking seriously their responsibility for water quality.
That's the big change that's occurred, from sort of denying that there's any involvement to sort of saying, yeah, we know we're part of it and we need to do something.
There are many ways farmers can be part of the solution. The first step is to know where they have a problem.
So right now it's just going through a mixing process. It's all being controlled by this iPad here.
Carl Peterson of Iowa State Extension is showing farmers a portable machine that brings chemical testing right to the farm field. His colleague Jamie Benning says monitoring technology is getting cheaper and more accessible.
In the past, we've had the late spring nitrate test available, something you would need to take in the field and send to a lab, so that can cause some challenges in terms of timing.
Now, farmers can get instant data that will allow them to calculate exactly how much fertilizer to put on their fields. If they use just what their crops need and apply it at the right time, farmers can help prevent the chemicals from running off the land and into water. Farmers like Carol Miller.
Conservation management depends on each individual farmer on his or her own farm. So that's what, you know, we've been looking at, too.
And they're looking at an investment, possibly thousands of dollars plus lost crop acres. Government incentive money can help farmers plant cover crops or put in wetlands or try other methods of keeping nitrogen on the land, whether it's tile drained or not.
It's not a cookie cutter type, industrial type situation where it works here, it should work there.
That's why being able to measure what's in your own soil or water is so important, and why Jamie Benning wants more farmers to see for themselves. She has brand new kits ready to hand out.
It's very simple. We have the tagline, 61 seconds to cleaner water, because it's something that can be done very quickly.
Implementing the cleanup strategies, on the other hand, takes time and money. But farmers are coming around to the notion that if they don't take action, the government may force them to. And that prospect is almost universally reviled in farm country. Amy Mayer, Harvest Public Media.
Later on today, we'll learn about the big food companies pushing farmers on conservation. A couple weeks ago, we spoke with Jennifer Mita Robinson about farmers markets. That's S apostrophe on farmers, and yes, that's an important detail, she said. Farmers possess a certain ownership over markets, but so do buyers. That's how local food works best, she says.
The freshness, the quality, the connections, the sustainability, the stewardship that goes into growing it. And so both sides need to show up.
She is the author of the Farmers Market book, Growing Food, Cultivating Community. It's about the food, yes, but it's also about showing support for the people who grow it.
We want people who are extending the possibilities of what it means to live close to a place and be really part of a place and help others to connect to where they live through what they eat.
Earth Eats' Annie Corrigan is speaking with her again. Today, she talks about the educational opportunities that exist at markets and how do we regulate what's sold in these spaces. But first, a question that often pops up in discussions like this. how do we encourage new people to start shopping at farmers markets?
It's incumbent on the people who feel comfortable at markets to make others welcome, to extend the information about what a market is, what happens there, who's welcome. They do vary according to where you go in the country. So they tend to reflect the neighborhood that they're in. So there will be different people who feel comfortable. Of course, food is so complicated. So it's not just that the food's available or even that you have the money, but that you do feel comfortable going there. And you have to know what to do with the food.
Food is complicated. That is an interesting statement. So you listed a couple things. Why else is food complicated?
It says a lot about you, to yourself and to other people, perhaps most importantly. So serving your family a strange vegetable that they may not like has social consequences. They don't want to go to dinner at your house anymore, or, you know, they don't eat something that you spent your money on and spent your time on. It can show whether you are, you know, of a certain class or a certain ethnicity, whether you're carrying on your heritage or rejecting it or innovating or, you know, I mean, it says so much about how you position yourself in the world.
I'm stuck on words, so let's go back to the phrase farmer's market.
Yeah.
The USDA has taken the word organic. So now if you're a farm and you want to use the term organic to describe how you grow your food, you have to get USDA certification. Should we police the phrase farmer's market in a similar way?
I don't think policing is going to get us very far and won't necessarily have the desired effect of enabling lots of people to work the system really in a way that makes sense to them. So I think being more transparent about what each farmer's market is doing is a good idea. And along with that is educating the public about what to look for. So I had a great comment made to me recently this summer by somebody who was a big farmer's market fan but was new to Bloomington. And he said, oh, I love farmers markets, but that big market downtown, and this is the market where there's that is supervised by the city and is very careful that the people are growing the food that they're selling. He said that farmers market downtown is so big and so bustling, but it's not a real farmers market. And I said, well, what do you mean by that? And he said, well, I saw crates that said grown in California. And I said, well, maybe the crates are from California, but the food in the crates is from Indiana, or at least that there's a very concerted effort to make sure and that there are consequences if you break those rules. On the other hand, he likes to shop at a different market that is a producer-organized market that does not have at all the kinds of layers of scrutiny and could well actually be selling food from California in crates that said Indiana. So people don't really know what they're seeing, and markets could start to develop terms and publicize them that said this is a producer-vendor market. And that's an ongoing education because especially in a college town, but any community in the United States now has a lot of turnover. So every spring, every time there's a turnover of population, you know, you would want to say, here's our market and this is what we have. This is who's there.
I've often thought that about those crates. I've never actually verbalized it, but I've thought that.
Right.
I trust the market and I trust the checks and balances, and yet...
Yeah. Well, you know what you can trust is the vendors there. The growers will be policing each other. And if they have a question, then they'll go to the market manager because they're very competitive. They're there for a few hours a week and they need to make their money. And by and large, anything they don't sell goes on the compost pile. And maybe that's a chance to educate the farmers as well to say, you know what, that, you know, Georgia peach crate, not the best choice. Convenient, but sending the wrong message. I think they'd be, you know, interested to hear that perception. Yeah.
Can a farmer's market get too big?
I don't think so. I think big is good. Competition is good. More customers clamoring is good. People like to see the activity. Some people are put off. Some people are tired after a week of, you know, whatever work they do. I've heard from a hairdresser and teachers and people who just want to not have small conversations on their time off. But mostly, I think that the activity is great, and when it becomes too big, it will naturally split off, and we will have more markets that are able to be sustained by the buyers.
Jennifer Mita Robinson is a professor of practice at Indiana University's Department of Communication and Culture. Speaking with Earth Eats, Annie Corrigan. Chef Daniel Orr cooks professionally at Farm Bloomington. He cooks for fun at his mom's house in Columbus, Indiana. He moved back home after an international cooking career that included a stop in Anguilla. This recipe is a throwback to those days he spent in the Caribbean. It's for chicken, and it uses your grill. Here we go.
It's interesting, in the Caribbean, they always start any chicken dish recipe by putting the chicken in a bowl and then washing it or rubbing it with lots of lime juice. You know, I think that it started out as being a way to help preserve the chicken with the acid from the lime, but now it just tastes like the Caribbean whenever you do something like that. So just squeeze plenty of lime juice on it. Okay, and now we're going to add some different other flavors that we think of as Caribbean, some chilies. And this will use some jalapeno, seeds and all. And I'm going to put just a few slivers of our habanero here. Mince that up fine. Now we're going to add a little bit of garlic. And some of it will fall off when we can put it on the grill. So, and I'm also going to add a little bit of cilantro. We've got some rosemary. I'm just going to throw those leaves in their hole. We'll just kind of marinate this, kind of massage these herbs and spices into the chicken breast, putting a little bit of olive oil on top. Again, since we're going to grill this, we don't want to have too much oil on it. A little salt. And into the fridge it goes. And then we can let this marinate for about an hour and a half to 2 hours.
Some patience is required for this recipe, but it'll be worth it. Just wait. You can make some good use of this time with a pickling recipe we have for you, coming up after the break.
Production support for Earth Eats comes from Cardinal Spirits, a distillery making handcrafted spirits from regional ingredients in Bloomington, Indiana. More at cardinalspirits.com. And Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington.
Welcome back to Earth Eats. I'm Mark Chilla, glad to be sitting in for Annie Corrigan today. So while you're waiting for the chicken to marinate, make this recipe. You'll be glad you did come December.
Today what we've done is we've got some habaneros as well as some banana peppers and some Tabasco peppers, and we're going to pickle them. And what you do is you just take some plain old white vinegar, distilled white vinegar. I'm going to add about a quarter of a cup of sugar. And that's going to tame that vinegar a little bit so it won't be quite so astringent. And then we're going to add just a little bit of salt. And again, all of these ingredients are natural preservatives. The vinegar is a preservative, the salt's a preservative, sugar is a preservative. I'm just going to bring that to a boil. And I'm going to add some spices. I've got some cinnamon sticks. I've got three star anise. I'm going to stuff these peppers into a nice ball jar. And I leave the habaneros whole. Because if I was to cut them or pierce them, a lot more of the heat would come out. Then it's just going to make everything extremely hot, which is good for some people. I've got a couple slices of ginger I'm going to cram into that jar with the chilies. A few garlic cloves. Now my vinegar is boiling. And I'm going to ladle that onto those chili peppers. Being careful that I get those cinnamon sticks and star anise pieces in there too. Because they're going to continue to give off flavor as it sits and marinates. Let it cool down to room temperature, and then you can store these in the refrigerator. They'll last 6 to 8 months.
You got to keep these in the fridge since Daniel didn't process the jar in a pressure canner. And that's fine. They'll still develop a really nice pickled flavor. Grilling our marinated chicken with Daniel Orr just ahead. But first, another report from Harvest Public Media. Corn and soybean farmers often apply more than 1,000 pounds of fertilizer to every acre they farm. That helps farmers grow a lot of grain. But it can also destroy waterways from the Midwest to the Gulf of Mexico. Environmental groups say that those who benefit from this system, food companies and consumers, are partially to blame. And as Abby Wendell reports, some big food companies are starting to take notice.
Our food system is built on corn and soybeans. They sweeten our soda, create our condiments, feed our cows. But to grow massive crops, farmers depend on massive amounts of fertilizer. And when those chemicals wash away, they can pollute drinking water, destroy our fishing rivers, and suffocate sea life in the Gulf of Mexico.
No parent really wants to give their kid a glass of milk in the morning that may be linked to these sorts of issues.
Brooke Barton works for an environmental group that's trying to get companies to drive change, not by raising moral concerns, but financial ones.
The biggest risk for these companies is the reputational risk of being associated with issues like toxic algae and hypoxia.
Barton says companies like Coke, Nestle, and Unilever, the company that brings you Hellmann's mayonnaise, are beginning to put pressure on farmers to reduce how much they pollute. Hellmann's needs a lot of soybean oil for its mayo. That's why Unilever launched what it calls its Sustainable Soy Program in Iowa.
Really what it comes down to for us is continuous improvement.
Stephanie Milley is a senior manager for sustainability at Unilever's U.S. division.
How can they get better yields? How can they maybe use less fertilizer? How can they just better overall improve their practices?
Unilever's first step is figuring out what farmers are doing that's contributing to the problem. Farmers don't easily share this information because the way they farm is akin to a trade secret. So the company is bribing them with an extra 10 cents for each bushel of soybeans they grow. In exchange, farmers fork over the details, reporting things like how much fertilizer they spray, what kind, and when. Unilever turns this information into environmental footprints and shares them with the farmers.
You know, they can look and see they've got one field that might be using or nitrogen or something, and they can go back and look and say, why is this different from, you know, my neighbors? Hopefully trigger some of those thoughts and have them investigate to continue to improve their practices.
By the end of this year, Unilever hopes to have 250 farmers in the program. Craig Fonce signed up when Sustainable Soy launched 3 years ago.
I like it, yeah. What got me into it, to be honest, the 10 cent premium.
Now, he says the knowledge he's gained is more valuable. For instance, he has a clearer picture of his farm's problem spots.
Now we're starting to get into some rolling ground here.
Fonce is cruising around his more than 2,000 acres of corn and soybeans. He pulls his red pickup to a halt and points out a particularly steep slope.
You get a combine on that slope and you'll kind of wonder, what am I doing here? It probably shouldn't even be farmed.
This field is prone to erosion. During heavy rains, the water washes away his topsoil and fertilizer. He knows this is bad for the environment, and it's bad for his bottom line. He spent money for the fertilizer, and he only has so much topsoil. That's why Fonce says he's planting a cover crop to hold things in place. But for the food company pushing him in this direction, well, there's a difference between real progress and good PR.
Ultimately, for this to be credible with consumers.
Again, Brooke Barton from the environmental group, Ceres.
The companies need to show that there are real changes over time in production impacts. Water quality improvements, soil health improvements. This is, you know, the end game.
To really have an impact on water pollution in the Midwest, companies will need to push more farmers from information gathering to action. And just as farmers react to a little coaxing from companies to do a better job, companies react to pressure from consumers. Abby Wendell, Harvest Public Media.
Listen to these stories again on our website. You can find even more stories from farms and food companies and dinner tables, all at harvestpublicmedia.org.
So we got our chicken nice and marinated.
Chef Daniel Orr by his grill.
Okay, I'm going to kind of shake off the excess marinade. We're cooking the skin side first, marking it, cooking most of the fat out of it, and then we'll turn it over and cook the flesh side. You don't want to keep flipping it over and back. You know, you want to just basically mark it on both sides and then turn your heat down and cook it slowly so you don't get it burnt. So it takes a little longer, but that's what it takes to make a perfect chicken breast. Okay, and you see some of those peppers and the herbs are falling on the grill, and those are going to smoke and give the chicken a wonderful flavor.
This will actually take you 25 minutes or so, but we'll magically fast forward now.
All right, let's give this a look. Take a little look here. What I always like to do is to look between the tenderloin and the breast, and it should be cooked through. Whenever you roast something or grill something, it's best to let it rest a little bit, which means just to take it off the grill and let it sit before you serve it. It's what's called carryover cooking, and that means that exterior of the bird or whatever meat you're cooking is going to be hotter than the interior. So you're allowing that excess heat to penetrate into the meat and to make sure that it's cooked. And if you do that, you'll tend not to have a dry chicken. What happens is people want to have the chicken cooked well done, but it's still cooking from the carryover cooking, so then it dries out. And then after you take off the chicken from the grill, the Caribbeans aren't finished with it. Okay, and what they do to finalize it, a little more lime juice, okay, a little sea salt, so it adds a kind of a saline crunch to the dish. Okay, and then I'm going to add just a little bit of smoked paprika. Get the margaritas going. It's time for a Caribbean chicken special.
Doing a search now on eartheats.org for cocktail recipes. Let's see. There's one with lemon verbena, another with cranberries that's good for wintertime holidays. Ooh, and a mint julep recipe. Have fun exploring. You'll see the recipes tab on the top of the Earth Eats homepage.
Production support for Earth Eats comes from Cardinal Spirits, a distillery making handcrafted spirits from regional ingredients in Bloomington, Indiana. More at cardinalspirits.com. And Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Will Murphy, executive producer.
It's always fun to sit in for Annie Corrigan, but don't worry, she'll be back next week. Thanks for being with me. For Earth Eats, I'm Mark Chilla.